thanks for downloading this podcast from RNIB Connect Radio. On RNIB Connect Radio.
That was the awesome Beatles there with Love Me Do, kicking off today's happy hour with me, Claire Sisk, and the ever so lovely Paulina. And it's a very special one today with the coronation weekend upon us.
We're going to take a look at the RNIB library for some royal-themed biographies. I hear a lovely recipe for a great street party food, and I do hope you're ready for this one, Claire, because it sounds delicious.
Drooling already.
We're also going to play amazing tracks that you can tap your feet to, and we'll take a peek behind the history of the coronation.
So we are going to be travelling back in time for a little history lesson, but not going too far back. 1983 tune here, Ain't Nobody, Chaka Khan. Such an awesome, happy track from Rufus and Chaka Khan there. Hopefully we are giving you some song inspirations for your celebrations this weekend. Now, it's time to travel back in time. Our Amelia chats with the National Archives about their historic records on the coronation.
Before King Charles III has his historic coronation, we're going to look back in history at previous coronations with Sean Cunningham and Neil Johnson from the National Archives. Hi, Sean and Neil. Can you remind us of the history of the National Archives and the kind of records that you store?
The National Archives is a government department. We are the archive of government business over the past 1,000 years. So everything from Doomsday Book right through to modern government tweets and emails, a very rich collection of detailed papers about monarchy, about the law, about landholding, and about how those things are challenged and questioned in the process of ruling, so petitions or legal cases, and as well as everything of big importance to the country, wars and disasters and all the rest of it. So it's a good record of how the governors and the rulers of this country have kind of used the written record as a way of recording what they've done. So we're now based out at Kew in West London, near to Kew Gardens, but not quite. So we're in a purpose-built building with lots of storage space here. And we're moving, obviously, from the printed and the written record towards digital material coming in from government. A very small percentage is preserved for the future, but ensuring that is in really good condition in another 1,000 years' time is one of our key roles. And we also link to other archives around the country in England and Wales. So it's a kind of network of information about how this paper trail has been generated over the past 1,000 years in all aspects.
Way back hundreds of years ago, what were some of the traditions and celebrations that we would have expected when coronations took place?
Well, we started trying to look for the kind of balance of records that we have, because what we have most of is the payment trail and the planning side of it, and not a lot about the narrative or reporting. A lot of it's linked to the heralds, who kind of organised pageantry and made sure everyone was in the right place and all of the precedents were in place, so you didn't get people of different rank in superior sittings and that kind of thing, which will still be applied today at the coronation. And obviously the coronation is a key moment which requires the most magnificent kind of setting of royalty and monarchy in the public space. So there would always be a procession from the Tower of London through to Westminster Palace the day before the coronation. And then there'd be a ritual bath for the monarch before processing on foot from Westminster Hall to the Abbey. So the pageant of coronation procession the day before was the chance for the public to see kind of monarchy in person. And it would be where the clothing would be most spectacular. You'd have new knights of the bath from the late 14th century, that becomes a tradition where the monarch would knight a load of new knights and they'd have a role in the procession, but you'd see everybody dressed in purple and white silk and gold. The coronation procession is really important because it's literally designed to dazzle the citizens of London, and they'll spread that news out to the country that there's a new king on the throne, and boy did they look like a king. Yeah, so we're all going to stay loyal. There's also the gift giving side of it and gifting of roles. So as soon as the monarch announced the coronation, there'd be a court of claims set up so that people who had traditional connections to the crown could claim a role in the coronation based on their relationship, either through their estates or through a direct role of office like the Earl Marshal. In the past, people could claim the right to serve the king his wine in his cup and then claim the cup afterwards. The ceremonial butler of England could keep all of the undrunk wine from the ceremony. Because those offices still exist, they'll still be able to make those claims. So it's a bizarre, again, a bizarre throwback to the sort of Middle Ages.
I think there's also the issue of people not necessarily wanting to attend, because in the pre-modern period, opposition to monarchy was a big part of the politics of the country. So the crown was insistent, very, very insistent, that people who were meant to be there showed up. So letters were orders, effectively, to attend were issued, and money was to be gifted to the crown. And this was quite rigorously enforced.
There's an awful lot of politics around things like the Wars of the Roses and the Civil Wars in the 14th century as well, where the coronation is really a reset as part of the resolution of some sort of civil conflict.
How did a coronation help resolve these conflicts?
A lot of it's about different rights to rule. So it's cousins claiming different rights. So certainly in the 15th century, with Henry VI and Edward IV and Richard III, Henry VII, all being more or less related, but all claiming different rights to rule. And at different points, they have to use their coronation to kind of enforce that change of regime. So there's an awful lot of politics put into these ceremonials to bring people in who might have been opponents, to offer them a route back to service and loyalty, and therefore to reward and a better political role. But also, they would run a parliament at the same time as the coronation. So it's a good time to put the boot into their opponents if they so wanted, because it does set the tone. It just broadcasts this idea that this person is fit to rule, especially if they've come through a period of warfare and they've won the crown through violence, like Henry VII did at the Battle of Bosworth. Crowning in the appropriate kingly and regal way as soon as possible brushes aside all these doubts about whether he really is the right person to rule or if he really has got the claim. You know, the ceremony with religious dimension, the very act of anointing with his holy oil, is a very powerful way of saying God endorses this person to be the ruler. It's a brave person who then stands against that, really.
Although we've been talking about how important it was for people to stick very closely to what's been done before to show their legitimate rulers, are there any big changes that have happened?
Well, the biggest change we could see in terms of how people will appreciate it today is that change to televise it in 1953. Churchill was slightly worried about the whole ceremony being presented almost like a theatrical performance. He didn't think that the solemnity of it all would be preserved by the fact that the cameras were there. So it was quite a big thing when it was televised, but the appetite was incredible to get the footage. The film stock was actually flown to Canada on the night of the coronation to be uploaded and broadcast in America and Canada, you know, as soon as possible. I think, you know, and it was broadcast on TV as well in the UK, but there was only something like 1.45 million people with TV sets in that day. So again, it brought people together to watch the TVs and have street parties. It connected people in a remote but linked way to what was going on in London, going back in time. There'll be all kinds of different, very small ways in which they would have exerted their influence over this process. But I think binding them into that tradition is what it was all about for them.
Well, thank you so much, Sean Cunningham and Neil Johnston from the National Archives, for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio to give us a history lesson in previous coronations.
Thank you so much, Amelia. And we'll take another look at the National Archives later on the happy hour as Neil and Sean tell us about a special little book that looks at some of the past coronations and maybe some little blunders that have not gone as well over the centuries. And speaking of things maybe not going according to protocol, I believe you found a really funny news story for us, and it involves a horse.
It does. So briefly earlier online when I was scrolling, I came across the headline that
a king's guardsman's horse started eating a lady's ponytail while she was posing for a picture with them in the background.
I mean, it was probably just...
Could you imagine that?
I imagine it was doing it lovingly, I would guess. It probably was just like, what a beautiful, beautiful ponytail.
Mane of hair.
Yeah, let me nibble on it. Let me do it up for you. Just let me fix it.
Let me slick that back.
And well, on that grand news story, we still have a few things coming up. Claire, what are they?
We also have more great music. Robert will take a look at some royal themed books in the RNIB library. And it wouldn't be the happy hour if Paulina and I didn't talk about food. So we'll be looking at a delicious party food recipe for lamb kebabs after Emily Sandé.
Are you ready for an extra long weekend of celebrations? Well, whether you're planning for a large or a small gathering, a cozy tea party or a lively street one, you definitely can't go wrong with a delicious recipe that can be prepared ahead of time and shared with everyone. Well, today, sharing their perfect coronation weekend recipe is Kim.
Hi, my name's Kim Jay and I'm a sight-impaired chef. I absolutely love cooking, and sort of one of my favourite recipes, which I did for the Jubilee, is lamb kebabs. Now, they are amazingly easy to make. You can make them up in advance, and if you love your spices, it is well worth doing. When I did this for the Jubilee, there was lots of dishes which all the neighbours did. I made several myself, but it was the lamb kebabs that went within literally the first 10 minutes. With the coronation coming up, we're having another street party, and I've already had requests for the lamb kebabs. So I'm going to share this recipe with you. Now, the ingredients that you're going to need for this lamb kebab recipe is 450 grams of lean lamb mince. You can substitute it for pork, beef, or even if you're vegetarian and vegan, soya mince. One small onion, which you peel and chop very finely. 3 cloves of garlic, which you peel and again chop really finely. 3 small green chilies, again chopped very finely. If you don't like your spices, don't use the green chilies. If you love your spices, you can always add a little bit more. And into that, you also put a handful of fresh coriander, finely chopped. You're going to need 1 teaspoon of salt, 1/2 teaspoon of chili powder. Again, you can increase that if you want or decrease it. 1/4 teaspoon of turmeric powder. 1/2 teaspoon of garam masala powder, 1 teaspoon of cumin seeds, and about 5 to 7 slices of white or brown bread, which you blitz or chop very finely. Now you get all these ingredients and you stick them into a mixing bowl. What you do is you mix it all together. And once it's all mixed together, get a handful of this mince mixture, put it in your hands and squeeze it. Now, if the mixture stays in like sort of a hard ball, you'll have little bits that sort of come loose. You've got enough bread in there, but if it's loose, add a little bit more bread until when you squeeze that mixture, it holds together. Now, once you've done that, you get a handful of the mixture and you shape them into kebabs, which are like sausage shapes, approximately about 2 to 3 inches in length and about sort of 3/4 of an inch in diameter. Shape it into kebabs and you keep doing that until you've used all your lamb mince. Now, you then put it into the fridge for at least 1/2 hour. Now, this will allow the bread to kind of soak in the fat of the mince. And it will also kind of stiffen the mixture. Once you've done that, you can put the kebabs into the oven on about 200 degrees for about 30 minutes. Pull it out and it is perfectly done. And it is amazing. The aroma of these lamb kebabs cooking, just, it literally fills the house. And if you're not hungry, you are hungry by the end of it. Now you can serve these in pita breads or wraps. And I always make a mint chutney to go with it. Very, very easy. You get some Greek yogurt, a small jar of mint jelly, put the whole jar of mint jelly into the Greek yogurt, a little bit of salt, a little bit of black pepper, a bit of coriander, mix it all together, and you get a very easy, fast mint sauce. And it goes really well with these lamb kebabs. Now, you can make the lamb kebabs up in advance. You can make them up a couple of days beforehand, put it into the fridge until it's ready to use. Or you could do what I do. I make a massive batch, always have it in the freezer, and whenever I need it, I pull it out, cook it from frozen, give it another extra 5 minutes in the oven, 5-10 minutes, and it is amazing. Well worth trying and great for a celebration, especially for the coronation.
If you would like to follow along with this recipe for your coronation weekend celebrations, it is up on our podcast. Just search for RNIB Connect on your favorite podcast platform. And whilst you're there, why not check out some of our other coronation content? We take a look at some talking books with a royal flair, learn about the Crown Jewels collection, share the history of coronations, chat all things tea, and much more. So once again, you can find it on RNIB Connect on podcast.
Well, that recipe has left me salivating for sure. I do love a kebab. What are your favourite party foods?
Potato salad. Yep, I'm a simple girl. Give me a bowl of potato salad and I can sit with a spoon and I will be very, very happy.
Eat it straight out the bowl.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm not going to share. It's mine. You want a potato salad? You bring your own. I am not sharing.
And do you like it plain or do you like it with like bits of onion and chives?
Listen, any. I'll throw in some bacon.
Bacon? I've never tried that.
Yeah, throw in some bacon. Make it fancy.
Oh.
Crispy bacon on top. Delicious. So nice. Ooh. What is your choice? What is your favorite party food?
It's got to be cake.
Any particular one?
Any cake. The more, the better.
Like a selection.
Yeah, just cake.
A flight of cake.
Yeah, I used to be a real chocolate cake lover, but now I'm all about like a Victoria sponge or a cherry cake or anything almond flavour like cherry Bakewells. Yeah, just cake. All the cake.
So does that mean you're baking some?
No. I say that. I might, but my mum has made a crown cake on a cushion.
Oh my gosh.
So I look forward to getting my nashes around that.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Well, we do actually have a nice, slightly food-related song coming up just now. And then we'll be taking a look at the RNIB library for some royal-themed reads. But for now, here's Eagle Eye Cherry, probably singing about saving some of that cake for tonight.
That was Eagle Eye Cherry and Save Tonight on RNIB Connect Radio. And this is the Happy Hour with Claire and Paulina. On today's show, we are chatting all things coronation, and to celebrate this historic event, R. Robert Kirkwood has been going through the RNIB library for books by and about King Charles III. Today, he's reading some biographies. They're my favourite kind of books.
Biographies of King Charles III, available from RNIB Talking Books. The Prince of Wales by Jonathan Dimbleby. For this remarkable study of the then heir to the British throne, Jonathan Dimbleby was given unprecedented access to his subject, as well as spending many hours in wide-ranging and candid conversations with Prince Charles. The author has interviewed scores of people, including his personal staff and close friends, most of whom had never talked openly about the prince before. The author has also drawn freely from the prince's own archives, including more than 10,000 letters, private journals and diaries none of which has hitherto been made public. Just before midnight on the 14th of October 1948, a proclamation was posted on the railings outside Buckingham Palace announcing that Princess Elizabeth had been safely delivered of a son. A little earlier, a policeman on the gate had already whispered the word, and the crowd, which numbered more than 3,000, had duly serenaded a tall figure crossing the courtyard with, "For he's a jolly good fellow," in the mistaken belief that he was the Duke of Edinburgh. Now they peered inside each car that crunched across the gravel and gave the unyielding profile of Queen Mary, the infant's great-grandmother, a cheer of unaffected warmth. The enthusiasm swelled with the crowd, so that soon after midnight, a police car cruised round the Victoria Monument, urging the celebrants through a megaphone, "For a little quietness, please." In Trafalgar Square, the fountains sparkled blue for a boy, while editors in Fleet Street shuffled headlines and composed their thoughts for the following day. The message was cabled abroad at once. Across the Empire and the Commonwealth, as in Britain, they raised the Union Jack, hung out the bunting, and rang the church bells. Warships of His Majesty's naval fleet on station across the globe fired a royal birthday salute. Radio stations throughout the United States interrupted scheduled programs with the announcement, which led every news bulletin and formed the lead story across the front pages of an entranced American press. On the 16th of November, Winston Churchill rose from his place in the House of Commons to congratulate Princess Elizabeth. The leader of the opposition was at his most mellifluous. "Our ancient monarchy renders inestimable services to our country and to all the British Empire and Commonwealth of Nations. Above the ebb and flow of party strife, the rise and fall of ministries and individuals, the changes of public opinion and fortune, the British monarchy presides, ancient, calm, and supreme within its functions, over all the treasures that have been saved from the past, and all the glories we write in the annals of our country. Our thoughts go out to the mother and father, and in a special way today, to the little prince, now born into this world of strife and storm." Read by John Cartwright. The Prince of Wales by Jonathan Dimbleby runs for 23 hours and 44 minutes. Our second biography of King Charles III, Prince Charles, The Misunderstood Prince by Sally Smith. Drawing on extensive access to the royal family's inner circle, Sally Beryl Smith delivers unprecedented insights into Prince Charles, a man who possesses a fiercely independent spirit and yet has spent his life in waiting for the ultimate role. Beginning with his lonely childhood, Smith details his intellectual quests, his entrepreneurial pursuits, and his love affairs, from the tragedy of his marriage to Diana to his eventual reunion with Camilla, as well as his relationship with the next generation of royals, including Will, Kate, Harry, and his beloved grandchildren.
The contrast between Charles's honeymoon with Diana and his own parents' idyll at Broadlands and Birkhall in 1947 was striking. For Princess Elizabeth and Philip, Broadlands was a haven of happiness they had each enjoyed while growing up. Birkhall in the Scottish Highlands was resonant with memories of a carefree childhood before her father became king. In letters to her parents during the honeymoon, they spoke of the depth of their mutual adoration and their determination, in Philip's words, to be joined in a new combined existence, able to withstand the shocks directed at us and serve as a force for good. For Charles and Diana, Broadlands was an unfortunate reminder of the absent Dicky, not to mention the very place where the prince had courted Camilla for 6 months in 1972. The newlyweds spent 2 days in the 18th-century mansion with its rolling grounds. Charles fished in the swift waters of the River Test, but failed to catch any salmon. Writing to a friend about his reaction to the wedding, Charles seemed detached from his personal feelings, describing instead how moved he had been by the public's good old-fashioned innocent enjoyment. It was on their two-week Britannia voyage through the Mediterranean that the gulf between the newlyweds emerged. Diana dashes about, chatting up all the sailors and the cooks in the galley, etc., Charles wrote to one of his friends, while I remain hermit-like on the veranda deck, sunk with pure joy into one of Lawrence Vanderpost's books. They had candlelit dinners and went ashore for picnics on secluded beaches. But Charles's bachelor ways ran deep. He needed solitude to paint, read, and write letters. Diana, by turns, craved his attention and stewed over her jealousy of Camilla.
Prince Charles, the Misunderstood Prince, by Sally Smith, is read by Laurel Lefko, and it runs for 18 hours. Arthur's biography of King Charles III, Rebel Prince, The Power, Passion and Defiance of Prince Charles, by Tom Bower. Few heirs to the throne have suffered as much humiliation as Prince Charles. Despite his hard work and genuine concern for the disadvantaged, he has struggled to overcome his unpopularity. After Diana's death, his approval rating crashed to 4% and has only been rescued by his marriage to Camilla. Nevertheless, just one-third of Britons now support him to be the next king. Many still fear that his ascension to the throne will cause a constitutional crisis. That mistrust climaxed in the aftermath of the trial of Paul Burrell, Diana's butler, acquitted after the Queen's sensational recollection. In unearthing many secrets surrounding that and many other dramas, this book reveals a royal household rife with intrigue and misconduct.
In early November 2000, Scotland Yard's Detective Chief Inspector Maxine de Brunner, one of Britain's most senior female police officers and marked within the Metropolitan Police as a high flyer, was given an unusual tip by a retired police officer. A director of Spink, a respected auction house and fine art showroom in Mayfair, had boasted, while intoxicated, at a party during an antiques fair in America that he was selling a 2-foot gold and silver model of a dhow, originally worth an estimated £500,000. The piece, he said, had been a wedding gift from the Emir of Bahrain to Charles and Diana. Just how Spink obtained the model was unclear, but its path from Kensington Palace to Mayfair was undoubtedly murky. While de Brunner considered her next step, a national newspaper reported the story, illustrated by a photograph of the dhow in Spink's window. Our hand was forced, admitted one of the officers on de Brunner's squad. They had to investigate. The following day, de Brunner and other officers drove to Mayfair and seized the expensive piece. Spink's records showed that the dhow had been brought to the showroom on the 11th of November 1997, about 10 weeks after Diana's death. The seller was Harold Brown, a butler at Kensington Palace. His contact at the showroom was one Jan Havlik. Further searches in the records showed that Havlik had previously bought, also from Brown, a diamond and emerald pair of Diana's earrings and a bangle. He had paid £1,200 in cash for the dhow. Spink was selling it for £30,000, as some of the precious stones were missing. Days later, de Brunner led a raid on Brown's flat at Kensington Palace. They found that the apartment was filled with Charles and Diana's possessions, including the dhow's base. The butler was arrested.
Rebel Prince, The Power, Passion and Defiance of Prince Charles by Tom Bower is read by Paul Noble and runs for 14 hours, 51 minutes. For more information about these royal books and well over 30,000 other titles of fiction and non-fiction, head to rniblibrary.com. or call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 and ask about talking books.
Thank you so much, Robert. Now, you know what, Claire? You have mentioned that you love biographies, but is there a particular book you really enjoy, especially, you know, on a very long weekend?
Do you know what?
I'm really into sort of the sort of self-help positive books at the moment. I'd been reading James Smith's Confidence, and I think a lot of the time we know this stuff is there, and we know, you know, we know what these authors are telling us to do, we need to do. But I think when someone starts actually saying, no, do this, you can do this, you think, yeah, I can. And I found them, especially going to bed, before going to bed at night, if I can't sleep, I find reading those, I have really positive dreams. So that's what I'm enjoying at the moment. What about you? I bet you have a cup of tea when you're reading a book, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I do that in the evening. I have a nice cup of tea with a good fantasy book. But you know what? In the morning, I actually feel like my morning read is usually something like a self-help book, because it just makes me feel a lot more productive if I do that.
Yeah, I think they'd certainly help with your sort of your thought process, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. You just feel like you're doing something for yourself, like you're doing something good for your mind or your body, you know, whichever type of self-help book you're actually reading.
Definitely.
So if you are in a bit of a rut in the morning, it is a much better option, I think, rather than, you know, sometimes I watch a bit of telly in the morning and
yeah,
I feel really, really unproductive after.
And I mean, a lot of the time the news is a bit doomy and gloomy, isn't it? So a bit of positivity in the morning is all good for the mental health and well-being.
Yeah, which is what we're all about in the happy hour. And speaking of well-being, we have my favorite segment coming up. I think you like it as well, Claire. Of course, I'm talking about a music therapy moment. And I think we'll also return to the National Archives as well. And of course, we'll be playing more music. Claire, we have something lined up just now. What's the song?
I love 60s music, and this is one of my favourites, Dusty Springfield, Wishing and Hoping.
Wishing and hoping and thinking and praying, planning and dreaming each night.
And we return on the happy hour to the National Archives. This time, Amelia hears about a very special little book.
I'm with Dr. Sean Cunningham and Dr. Neil Johnston from the National Archives to talk about one of their favourite historical records relating to past coronations. So can you tell us a bit about this record?
We've got a lovely little document called The Little Device, which is a little book that was probably drawn up in the 15th century, almost like a herald's narrative of what goes on. But the copy we've got was probably made in the mid-17th century. It looks like it's been made for maybe Charles II's return. And it's looking back to these later medieval ceremonies to see what had happened. It's almost like a little newspaper article of who was there, how did the procession go, did anything go wrong? And they're going to point out, you know, some of those things that didn't work properly, where someone was in the wrong order, or a bishop forgot his lines, or they put the ring on the wrong finger. Things like this goes down in these books because they remember to do it right the next time. In some cases, they've just literally overwritten the names of people involved in one ceremony who've either died or have changed office for the next monarch. Richard III and Henry VII, say, were crowned quite close together. Henry VII didn't really have time to do anything different at all. He got out the same book from Richard III's reign and just wrote his own men's names in over the top of the names of Richard III's. One of the scaffoldings collapsed at his coronation halfway through the ceremony, actually in the abbey. Nobody was hurt, but it caused enough for the herald to write it in his account. And similarly, when they used to walk from Westminster Hall into the abbey, they would walk barefooted under a canopy of estate carried by officers. And as they passed, crowds would normally try and tear a strip of the cloth off as a souvenir. So we did have coronation souvenirs even in the Middle Ages. The first Tudor Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth of York, who's Henry VII's wife, and there was such a crush when she passed that several people were killed in the squash to get a slice of her coronation carpet. That was also noted because it was a failure of the officers to stop the crowds. Over-enthusiastic and potentially dangerous situation when you get so many people in a small space, resonant of what we'll see and what we have seen in recent state events where barriers have kept the public separated, but clearly that was a problem in the past as well. I think one of Henry VIII's first jobs as a young boy, when he was 10 years old, he was made Marshal of England for the wedding day, which meant he was in charge of policing the route through London. So he had 100 men in cloaks with big sticks. So it's an interesting little snapshot, this little device, to show how the practicalities and some of the quirks of it were passed on between different reigns because it was important to remember these things, even if you couldn't do it yourself.
And even in a practical sense, it mattered, because by the time Charles II, more than a generation has passed, really, since the previous coronation. Sir George Walker, who was charged with organising Charles II's coronation, he needed to look back to know exactly what to do.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Sean Cunningham and Dr. Neil Johnston from the National Archives, for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio to talk about the little device.
Thank you so much, Amelia. Now, we're almost at the end of the show, and of course, our music therapy moment is coming up. And I have to say, this week's choice will be a great one. It's a song that even the king himself can't resist dancing to. But before that, let's have some U2.
And that's it for today's happy hour. It was lovely keeping you company, and I hope you enjoy this week's extra long coronation weekend. Paulina and I will be back again at the same time next week, so make sure you tune in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of our episodes on our podcast. Just search for RNIB Happy Hour Podcast wherever you listen to them.
Now for that final track of some music therapy. This week we have the one and only 3 Degrees. And apparently this is one of the King's favourite songs. Am I remembering that correctly, Paulina?
You are right. His Majesty actually named this track during a very special Thank You Day show on Hospital Radio. And it is, of course, Giving Up, Giving In by the 3 Degrees, which apparently gives the King an irresistible urge to get up and dance.
We might just join him on that one.
Absolutely.
But for now, have a great day, and we will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
You are listening to the Happy Hour Podcast, a trimmed down version of our hour long show. If you've enjoyed the songs and would like to hear them in full, along with all the interviews, tips and chat, just catch the full show on RNIB Connect Radio. We're on every Monday at 1 p.m. with a repeat Thursday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 10 a.m. But for now, thank you for listening to the Happy Hour Podcast.
For more downloads like these, visit rnibconnectradio.org.uk/podcasts.